We do know that even with strong action, climate will change quite strongly over the next 30, 40, 50 years, and that means that we're going to have to adapt.
Sir Nicholas Stern, the UK economist, who caught the attention of the business world when he warned of the huge costs of ignoring climate change, testified before the US Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This hearing would never have been held before the Democratic takeover of the Senate and its committees. It is a sea change in the development of American climate policy. Sir Nicholas advises former heresies like a cap on total carbon emissions for the United States, a carbon tax, and even a higher tax on gasoline. Let's go straight to the Senate for the 10-minute testimony of Sir Nicholas Stern, author of the Stern Report. Then we'll pick up on a couple of key questions and answers between Senators and Mr. Stern on contentious problems like the lack of carbon controls in China and India. Here is Nicholas Stern.
Chairman, Senators, it's an honor to be with you today. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee. Uncontrolled climate change will transform the physical geography and thus the human geography of the world. That is, where we live and how we live our lives. It involves great risks of economic and social disruption, migration and conflict. The recent report of the UN's expert panel of climate scientists, to which you referred, Mr. Chairman, confirms that global average temperatures have already risen 0.7 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels. If emissions continue to rise, the panel's central estimate of further warming for the end of this century is 4 degrees centigrade. This would also give a greater than 50% probability of increases over 5 degrees centigrade. Those of you who like to speak in Fahrenheit, that's 9 degrees Fahrenheit, in the next century. So more than 50% probability of increases of over 5 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century if we go on under business as usual. Their analysis is exactly in line with the analysis presented in the Stern Review last year. Warming on this scale is associated with widespread and serious impacts on the availability of water, on human health, on food production, and the environment. The impacts in the U.S. are likely to be substantial. For example, an increase in the intensity of hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, still greater water stress in California, sea level rise in Florida, and an increased risk of storm surges in New York. We've already seen how long-term shifts in weather patterns interact with other factors to generate movements of people and the conditions for conflict, for example, in Darfur and Sudan. Abrupt regional shocks become more likely as average temperatures rise, including the risk of sudden changes to monsoon rains in densely populated regions of South Asia, or significant reductions in water flow in the River Nile affecting 10 countries in North and East Africa. To reduce these risks to manageable proportions, we'd have to keep the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases below around 550 parts per million of CO2 equivalent. Even at this level, there are serious risks. Indeed, there is only a 50% chance that the eventual temperature rise would not exceed 3 degrees centigrade. So how can we reduce the risks? My initial observation is that previous delay in action means that we do not start in a good place. We cannot control the stock of gases already released into the atmosphere, but we can, as a world, control the future flows. A global problem requires a global response, and equity demands that rich countries take the lead. It's they who are responsible for the bulk of the problem, and it's the poor countries that will be hit earliest and hardest. Controlling emissions will not remove all the risks of future climate change, but it can drastically reduce them. And we've shown in the Stern Review that the cost of controlling these flows is much less than the damages that are thereby averted. The case for taking strong action across the world is compelling. And action is urgent. The later we leave it, the greater the risks, and the higher will be the costs of controlling them. So how much will it cost to reduce the risks? We estimated the cost to the global economy of around 1% of GDP, a cost similar to a one-off increase in the price or cost index. One-off. The models give a range of plus or minus 3% is a big range here. We're uncertain about these costs, but higher estimates embody rather pessimistic assumptions about progress in technologies. Of course, a cost of 1% of extra is not trivial, but it's similar to the costs we accommodate all the time, for example, by changes in exchange rates. That will not slow growth. It is failing to act that will eventually damage growth. The message from the economics of climate change is clear. We must act strongly, and we must act now. The damages that this strategy would avoid can be estimated in various ways. Taking account of the more serious risks that are now evident, simple economic models suggest that the damages averaged over time and over the range of possible outcomes are at least 5% of global consumption. There are uncertainties, there are technical challenges in the model, but there are in the modeling, but there's no case to believe that the economic impacts will be small. And indeed, on a number of key dimensions, the models we used underestimated the damages. For example, we excluded irreversibilities and a number of relevant risks. So what are the key elements of a strategy? First, we must ensure that we correct the biggest market failure the world has ever seen. People should pay in the prices they face for the costs of their actions, in this case, cost to the climate. Pricing carbon directly through either tax or carbon trading or implicitly through regulation is fundamental to a policy response. Given the global nature of the market failure and the efficiency that comes from using economic instruments, developing a global price for carbon is crucial. In Europe, we've long had strong taxes on fuel. The European Union has established the world's largest emissions trading scheme and is taking steps to ensure that it's long-term, ambitious, and open to trade with others. I hope that as your committee scrutinizes proposals for US policy, including the range of different suggestions for cap and trade, you will bear in mind not only the potential gains in terms of cost reductions of creating schemes that can link to those in the EU, Australia, and elsewhere, but also the value of using carbon finance as one key element in building cooperation on climate change with China and India and other developing countries, as Senator Domenici described. The US has shown how regulation and standards can build markets, for example, in energy-efficient domestic appliances and tackling other environmental problems such as lead in gasoline. Leadership in the world's largest market sets the pace elsewhere. Indeed, the Sudan now uses lead-free gasoline. China and India are taking steps of their own. For example, China is implementing a domestic goal of reducing the energy intensity by 20% in 5 years. And India, too, is focusing on energy efficiency and increasing renewable energy. But they can and will go further and faster with international support. Second element of the strategy, after the pricing element, we must invest in policy to bring forward low-carbon technologies. Spending on public energy research worldwide has halved over the last 20 or 30 years, and public and private investment are highly correlated, of course. As a world, we must double public R&D spending on energy, and we must promote the development of key technologies such as renewable energy and carbon capture and storage. Carbon capture and storage is a strategy that will allow us to continue to make use of abundant reserves of coal, vital for energy security, without causing unacceptable harm to the environment. Urgent steps are required to move towards widespread deployment of this technology as rich and poor countries alike invest in a new generation of coal-fired power generation plant. In transport, new technologies such as plug-in hybrid cars and the use of cellulosic ethanol could go a very long way to reducing emissions without changing our basic mobility. Further, these low-carbon technologies will create opportunities. Markets for low-carbon power generation technologies alone could be worth $500 billion a year by 2050. The third, final element of the strategy is that we have to recognize there are many ways to reduce emissions now that do not need new technology. Energy efficiency and combating deforestation are very inexpensive ways to reduce emissions, but they require decisions and action on policy and changes in behavior. For example, problems in building regulations and tenant landlord contracts can prevent energy efficiency investments being made. In the case of deforestation, solutions should be based on supporting the countries in which the trees stand to develop their own approaches to this complex problem. So given this, why would anyone deny this case for action? I've heard three reasons to do so. They're all, in my view, profoundly mistaken. The first is that the science is incorrect. I need to do no more than refer to the conclusions of the recent UN panel on the science, which you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, which reported so clearly and strongly only 10 days ago. Second reason for denial is that we can adapt as a human race to any rising temperatures. That, in my view, is reckless. it ignores the risk of very high temperature increases. Business as usual growth in emissions over the next 100 years would be likely to take us next century to a world that would be 5 or 6 degrees centigrade, more than 9 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than today. That's a change which is equivalent to the difference between now and the last ice age 10 or 12,000 years ago. It would transform the world, involving massive dislocation and in all probability conflict. A third reason for refusing to act is that such risks and their impacts will happen a long way into the future, and we, as this current generation, have little interest in what happens in the future. I trust that many of you would find this argument ethically untenable. Chairman, Senators, uncontrolled climate change constitutes a risk that, as a global community, we cannot afford to take. We have an understanding of the scale of action necessary and of the economic policies to deliver this action. Now is the time to act, urgently, strongly, and internationally. Strong leadership from the United States of America is of the utmost importance. The decisions made by this committee will be fundamental in creating that leadership. Thank you very much.
That was British economist Sir Nicholas Stern testifying before the Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007. Stern also warned that adaptation is becoming as important as cutting emissions.
Thank you. I would share with the others on this panel, and it's emphasized very strongly in the report, the importance of adaptation. I mean, what you're seeing and what we're all seeing is the effects of a temperature increase of 0.7 degrees centigrade relative to pre-industrial times. I think it's clear that however strong we are, and we hope we're very strong, on reducing emissions, we'll probably see something like 2 to 3 degrees centigrade altogether. So we've got another probably 2 degrees centigrade or close to 2 degrees centigrade coming, and we're only seeing at the moment the consequences of 0.7 degrees centigrade. So a lot of climate change will be there, and even if we act very strongly. So I think the adaptation story is fundamental, and information, of course, is fundamental to being people being able to adapt intelligently. So I would certainly share that.
Now let's look at China. The American senators brought up the common excuse for inaction in their country. Why should they regulate carbon or capture it using expensive new systems when the Chinese do nothing to control their vast coal-burning emissions? First of all, Sir Nicholas says the Chinese are aware of the problem and are taking some small steps to protect the environment.
China is no longer deforesting. It is now reforesting. China has, as I mentioned in my testimony, a 20% reduction in the energy intensity target within 5 years. Their 11th five-year plan started last year, and they are implementing and working on that in a very strong way, for example, through direct targets for the 1,000 biggest firms in China, recently extended considerably to lower-tier firms. You cannot sell an American car in China because it doesn't meet the emission standards, which are pretty high. Beijing has an $8,000 tax on SUVs. China, in late November, early December, instituted an export tax on energy-intensive goods, aluminium, steel, and cement. So China is grappling with this problem.
Then a senator brings up the problem of jobs going to Asia because multinational corporations will find the carbon control costs cheaper there, where regulations are not enforced. Sir Nicholas answers that concern.
When we take a look at the jobs from the U.S. or England migrating to China or India in search of cheap labor, those jobs are also in search of not just cheap labor, but also less regulation, lower costs. One of the aspects of that has nothing to do with the laws on the books of China or the laws on the books of other countries. Many countries have really strong laws dealing with the environment or minimum wages, but they're never enforced in a number of circumstances that I have pointed out previously. So my question is this: isn't there a natural tension with respect to the agents of production in a global economy searching for the lowest labor cost and the lowest production cost, therefore less environmental regulation, to search around the world where they have those opportunities, and the opportunity even in those countries, less developed countries, to oppose the kind of regulatory structure we've already imposed upon ourselves? We see it every day, see it all the time, see it in China and in India. What makes you, if that's the case, if there is this natural tension, and I believe there is, what makes you so optimistic with respect to both China and India?
What I said about China and India. I should say I emphasize it a bit more strongly for China than for India. I think China's moving a bit faster than India. It was about direction of movement. I think that those countries, those two countries, are changing very rapidly in their attitude to energy efficiency and the environment. They both realize that global warming really matters to them. Just, for example, from the point of view of the receding snow and glaciers in the Himalayas, that would increase water stress in much of the year for both countries, both India and China, which rely to a very large extent on water that originates in the Himalayas. And of course, the glaciers and the snows act as sponges, and they spread it out over the year. Without that, you'll have torrents and floods in the rainy season and dry rivers in the dry season. So they really do understand increasingly strongly how much it matters to them. And they also realize their increasing weight in the world economy and their responsibilities as key players in the world economy. But it's movement in the right direction. I'm optimistic about movement in the right direction, not necessarily about whether it will be fast enough and on a big enough scale to deal with this problem. And that's why I think that collaboration and participation, as Senator Domenici was describing, is so important. But in order to do that, to collaborate effectively with other people, I think you do have to recognize what they are trying to do. Just as I explained a little earlier, when we're in China, we go to great lengths to emphasize just what the United States is doing, because in China, you'll be told that the United States is doing nothing about this, and we're not going to move much more strongly unless the United States does. And we try to show that that argument is not well-founded, that actually there's intense discussion and a lot of action in the United States on those issues, for example, the kind of plant that you described in your own state, as well as, of course, what's going, the ambitions of California, the trading in the Northeast states, many cities in the United States, and so on. So we do emphasize that very strongly, and it's vital to build the collaboration, to have that mutual understanding. On the migration of jobs, we try to take that issue on directly in Chapter 11 of the report and review the evidence that there is on the mobility in response to environmental regulations, and to think that through in relation to the increased costs. It could be an effect. The question is, how big is that effect likely to be? And we have to get quantitative about that. If we're right that the extra cost to production costs to getting serious about climate change is of the order of 1% of GDP. That's like a 1% one-off increase in costs. That's significant, but in very few cases, I think, would it be of a kind that would trigger a big movement. That is small in relation to difference in wage rates of 5, 10, 15, a factor of 5, 10, or 15. So I think if you look at it carefully and empirically and look at the numbers and see how things move, that particular aspect of the story, the extra costs from trying to do things differently in terms of energy, would be a very small part of that story, and by itself, I think, unlikely to trigger a massive movement. It could be different in a few industries, and in those few industries, I think it's important to try to look for international agreement, steel, aluminium, cement. And we discussed those kinds of agreements in Japan and in China, and I think in those few industries which are very energy intensive, it would be possible to build sectoral agreements, but that would involve governments and private sector working together.
Well, Mr. Stern, thank you. And I certainly hope you're right. I understand what you're saying now. This is about direction rather than progress. If you feel that the Chinese have moved it, or at least started to think in terms of moving in a constructive direction, that's different than quantum progress. So I understand what you're now saying. I would only observe, and I don't mean to be either an optimist or a pessimist about this, that the agents of production, particularly those that have become much, much larger than they were decades ago, have always resisted additional regulations. And when they move to find the lowest cost unit of production capability in China or India or the Philippines, they will similarly resist regulation just as they did here for many decades. Most of what we've achieved through regulation has been over the objection of some very substantial interests in this country. I was just, and this doesn't relate to the environmental issue, but it relates to the same thing I'm talking about. The president of the Philippines some while ago said, I think we should need to increase the minimum wage in the Philippines. One of our corporations that's in the Philippines the very next day said, you do that, we leave. The same approach with respect to trying to retain low-cost production in these areas. And I asked the question about, is there tension with respect to the global economy and the agents of production searching for the lowest cost and the need for not only regulatory capability but enforcement that would produce real progress rather than just a positive direction in some of these countries?
An American senator points out there has been some progress using carbon capture and storage in his state. Here are several short clips about carbon capture and storage technology as a way to make sustainable fossil fuels.
There's one technology which we did emphasize and which you have emphasized, I believe rightly so, and that's carbon capture and storage for coal. And the reason for that is because it's so widely used, around 50% of electricity consumption around the world. It will be over 70% in India and China for the foreseeable future. Why? Because they've got lots of coal. It's under their ground. They don't have to import it. And it can be done quickly. You can get those power stations up quickly. And they're in a hurry because their economies are growing and lots of their people and industries don't have electricity supplies. So it's pretty obvious that they're going to be using coal over for electricity power generation for quite a long period of time. And so too Poland and Germany and the United States. It's not just India and China, but particularly India and China. There's an issue there on coal. What's the answer to that? In the short term, to use coal much more efficiently than they do. Move to supercritical, ultra supercritical burners. And that's the kind of technology which the rich countries can help with, just in terms of ordinary private investment activities. But we have to have an open view and encourage the transfer of those kinds of technologies. But as soon as we can, we have to move to the carbon capture and storage for coal. And we have to learn how to do that well. And I've lived and worked in India for more than 30 years now in various phases. I've lived and worked in China for nearly 20 years. And I've seen those two countries change quite remarkably in the last year or so in their attitudes to energy efficiency and their attitudes to the environment. There is some way to go, but I believe that there is a partnership there of the kind you described that can be forged. And friends say to us, look, you're emphasizing carbon capture and storage for coal. Sounds like a good idea. It will be more expensive, so we'll need some help with the carbon finance. It will require changes in technology and development and deployment of these technologies. We'd like some help with that too. In particular, show it works in your own countries. So I think if Europeans argue that carbon capture and storage is a good thing for India and China, they ought to show it works in Europe. I think it's a fair challenge from our friends in India and China. But I believe that we can rise to that challenge, and that is a particular area where I think the United States, with its ingenuity and creativity in technologies right across the board, could not only have a big role in creating these technologies, but also in showing how they can be deployed, and indeed gaining business from so doing.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Let me say I agree with Senator Domenici with respect to the use of coal, and Mr. Jacoby, we are going to use coal. The question isn't whether, the question is how do we use coal? And I think these projects are very important to find ways for the development of zero-emission coal-fired generating plants, for example. We have, in my state of North Dakota, the only plant in America that produces synthetic gas from lignite coal. About three decades ago, we were going to produce a lot of those, or build a lot of those plants. Only one was completed. We now produce synthetic natural gas from lignite coal. We have the largest application of sequestration of CO2 at that plant. We take the CO2 from this plant that turns lignite coal into synthetic natural gas. We pipe the CO2 to the oil fields in Alberta, Canada, and invest that CO2 back into the marginal oil wells to increase the productivity of oil wells. You sequester the CO2 from the synthetic gas plant. You dramatically increase the marginal capability of these marginal oil wells. I mean, it is exactly the kind of thing we ought to look to do. As we produce all of these biofuels, we ought to take a look at location with respect to using and capturing CO2 to further enhance
the productivity of oil development.
It's located all over the world. It's cheap. It's not located in places that are security problems. And it's hard to imagine we're not going to burn it over the next century. So carbon capture and storage is one of the essential technologies. If we can't make that work, we're in deep trouble. I would just say that we're near the completion of a study in which I participated at MIT on the future of coal. And that study, which should be out within a month, is going to argue that we should be spending a lot more effort on the development of coal capture and storage technology, doing studies at commercial scale. We are spending a lot of money in the United States. We do have the FutureGen program, but the argument is that's not enough.
Perfection's a tough ask. I think you need a combination of measures. In the report, we argue that regulation and standards can play an important role in giving confidence in the direction of a market. If you require unleaded gasoline and you state that that's going to come in and it's definitely going to come in, people can plan clearly on that basis. Similarly with catalytic converters or the STAR schemes that you have for electrical appliances, those kinds of regulations, either direct regulation or regulation on transparency and information, can, I think, develop markets. And I think the United States has shown the way in many cases on that. So partly, I think, regulation will have a role to play. Secondly, I think cap-and-trade policies have a powerful role to play. They will have a role to play in different areas, I think, from tax policies. Cap-and-trade in Europe covers about half of Europe's emissions. I mean, it's a big scope of the scheme. It's been going for 2 years, and we've learnt a lot along the way, and what we've learned is beginning to get embodied in our plans for the next stage. One thing we learned, which may come in the category of the blinding the obvious, but it is that if you give away too many permits, you're going to have a very low price for a permit. That's economics 101, I guess. And that's something which did happen in the early stages and which we've taken the lessons from now. And in the second stage of the scheme, which runs from 2008 to 2012, the plans for the permits around Europe are coming in now, and the Environment Commissioner who has to deal with them is taking a much more robust line than was the case first time round. So the scheme itself, I think, is a good scheme, but the way it's operated and the kinds of ways in which permits are issued will, of course, make a very big difference. So I think your emphasis on learning as you go, both about how the scheme operates and about how the technologies are coming forward to give you more opportunities, those kinds of ways have to be enshrined and embodied in the schemes. So you have to be strong on the ambition, so you have to have scarcity, otherwise markets don't work. You also have to, in this case, look long. Our third phase in Europe will be 2012 to 2020. The current periods of up to 2012 are far too short for people to make investment decisions in these kinds of industries. So going long is an important part of the design of a scheme, and being open to other trading schemes, being open to the possibilities of linking up with northeastern states, with California, with Australia as it comes through, with India and China as they start to develop. Openness, I think, will be an important part of of that story. So within cap and trade, I'd emphasize scarcity, long time horizons, and openness, but the ability to adjust along the way as information comes in. In Europe, taxation on gasoline is a very important part of the policy, and I think that has a role to play as well. So I would look across regulation, cap and trade, and taxation, and we've already, with Senator Domenici, laid strong emphasis on research and development and deployment, so I wouldn't cover that again. So I think that cap and trade's going to be crucial, but as part of a suite of measures, a suite of policies that looks across the board in the way I just tried to describe.
You have been listening to a summary of the testimony of Sir Nicholas Stern at the Senate Energy Committee on February 13, 2007, and this was prepared by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.